in my life. Hicks told the committee that he and the others trapped in the compound expected U.S. military reinforcements, but Washington never sent them. "Okay, we're on our own," he recalled telling his colleagues. "We're going to have to try to pull this off with the resources that we have available." Four brave Americans, Ambassador J. Christopher Stevens, Information Officer Sean Smith, and two CIA operatives, Glenn Doherty and Tyrone Woods, gave their lives that night in Benghazi. Despite Rice's dismal track record in international politics, and after she lied to America on national television, Obama rewarded Rice by making her his Secretary of State. In one of the only good decisions she's ever made, Rice withdrew her name from consideration. But that didn't stop Obama. 6 months later, he named her his National Security Advisor. Rice was accused of unmasking, which means revealing the names of U.S. citizens who were incidentally surveilled during targeted surveillance of foreigners during her tenure as National Security Advisor. Intelligence officers are required to follow a minimization policy, which directs them to leave identifying information on U.S. citizens incidentally surveilled out of intelligence reports unless very specific circumstances warrant revealing their identities. Initially, Rice said she knew of no such unmasking. Privately, she told House investigators she unmasked the identities of senior Trump campaign officials to understand why the Crown Prince of the UAE was in New York. Of course, her lying continued. Again, she went on a Sunday morning news show and said that Bo Bergdahl served the United States with honor and distinction. Sergeant Bergdahl wasn't simply a hostage. He was an American prisoner of war captured on the battlefield. Bergdahl would later plead guilty to deserting his fellow soldiers. What made the lie even more egregious was Obama's exchange of five high-risk detainees at Guantanamo, the Taliban Five, some of whom have predictably returned to the battlefield, for the deserter, Bergdahl. So why in God's name should we believe liar Susan Rice when she says she never sought to uncover the names of American citizens being surveilled for political purposes? The allegation is that somehow the Obama administration officials utilized intelligence for political purposes. "That's absolutely false," she told NBC's Andrea Mitchell. How invested was she in the deep state's campaign against Trump? Well, according to a former U.S. attorney, Susan Rice put together spreadsheets detailing phone calls of many of the people who worked in the Trump organization and for the campaign, including President Trump, which President Obama then made available to all intelligence agencies. How big is this pool of leakers? No one seems to know for sure. 6 people? 10? 2 dozen? Enough to sink the Titanic? Flood Washington? Who knows? One thing is certain. With each new person who gained access to the Obama administration's database of unmasked names, the chance of a leak increased exponentially, and every so-called journalist with a laptop and a cell phone was rubbing his or her hands. The unmasking of Americans by Obama's deep state began with General Michael Flynn. In early January 2017, just before Trump took office and just after Obama ripped up privacy protections by expanding the limits on sharing of raw NSA intelligence, the Washington Post published a story about Michael Flynn discussing Russian sanctions with the Russian ambassador, Sergei Kislyak. First, allow me to explain to you what's legal and what isn't in that last paragraph. What's legal and appropriate is for a top security advisor, of an incoming president to talk with officials of foreign countries, including officials representing countries that have difficult relationships with the United States. What's not legal is leaking the name of an American citizen captured in an intelligence report. Here's how the illegal process of unmasking can happen. Analysts from the NSA are allowed to surveil the phones of anyone whose communications are even remotely tied up with a person like Kislyak. If someone happens to find him or herself on the same email chain, that information goes straight to the intelligence gatherers. If Kislyak orders a pizza, the kid who answers the phone at Domino's is fair game. Under Section 702 of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, communications of U.S. persons can be legally captured during surveillance of a foreign target. This is how a bunch of people sitting at their laptops in some NSA office would manage to justify tapping the phone lines and email correspondence of the president-elect of the United States a few months later. But I'm getting ahead of myself. Now, try to forget that in a court of law, someone can't be found guilty by implication alone. It takes work to convict someone in public under the scrutiny of a judge and a jury made up of fine people like you. You would at least think that these records would be kept secret, wouldn't you? That no one outside the NSA should be able to peek and make copies whenever they feel like it. Wrong again. Remember Obama's executive order? Well, the EO directed people like Susan Rice in the days after Donald Trump was elected president to spend time pilfering every page of classified correspondence she could from the NSA. She and her co-conspirators at the Obama White House decided to store it in 6 different servers, all in different places. Is it something about being a liberal that makes you want to do that? I'll never understand it. And all of it was to build a stockpile of innocent Americans who could be cast as part of the phony Russian conspiracy. Michael Flynn has pleaded guilty not to making the phone call or to anything he said on the call, but to lying to the FBI. However, there are those within the FBI who believe Flynn did not intend to lie. This becomes even more troublesome when Andrew McCabe, deputy FBI director, arranged for and was present at the interview. Michael Flynn's unmasking, however, brought no consequences to Susan Rice or any other co-conspirator, and was such a successful tactic for the anti-Trump plot that unmasking became the deep state's signature move. If I had Susan Rice on the stand, I would instruct the jury to take her testimony with less than a grain of salt. However, I imagine a jury could figure that out for themselves after listening to her. Which brings us back to another conspirator I'd love to get on the stand, the former director of national intelligence, liar James R. Clapper Jr. Brennan may be pond scum, but Clapper lies for a living. Talk about being part of the deep state. Clapper's father, his wife, and her father all had careers in the National Security Agency. I guess going into this line of work for Clapper was a little like taking over the family pub, one where they've got little microphones under all the bar stools and copies of everyone's credit card information in the back. By 2001, he was head of the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, a little-known branch of the intelligence community that operates under the umbrella of the military. As head of that organization, Clapper got pretty comfortable operating far outside the realm of public opinion. He wasn't being watched by the media or Congress, and he probably became accustomed to doing things his own way. How else can you explain the widespread collection of data on American citizens he oversaw as Barack Obama's Director of National Intelligence? Did he not think he was going to get caught? When President Trump named General Michael Flynn his national security advisor, the appointment couldn't have thrilled Obama or Clapper. The appointment was akin to kicking sand in their faces. Obama had Clapper fire Flynn from his post as director of the Defense Intelligence Agency, DIA, in 2014, and then went to great lengths to try to talk our current president out of hiring him, but to no avail. President Trump undoubtedly knew why Obama had Clapper fire Flynn as director of the DIA. It was because Flynn had already started to upend the deep state. One of General Flynn's co-workers from that period told the Washington Post, the reason Flynn was fired was because he wanted to move intelligence analysts up and out of their cubicles into the field to support warfighters of high-intensity operations. In other words, he wanted to set a fire under the ass of the administrative state. Obama couldn't have that. Neither could Clapper. So, when President Trump made General Flynn his NSA head, the deep state had a conniption. Flynn was a direct threat to the status quo. So what did the deep state do? They unmasked him, leaked it, destroyed his reputation, and prosecuted him. So let me get this straight. Lying to the FBI is a chargeable offense. But swamp monsters like Cardinal Comey, Susan Rice, and Clapper can lie at will to Congress and the American people with impunity? By the way, it is not a crime for the FBI to lie to the American people, but it is a crime to lie to Congress, whether under oath or not. Why is it everybody else gets prosecuted, but not them? There is something very wrong here, but not for Comey. He gets to write a book on his falsehoods. Clapper gets to be a paid political pundit for the same network where he leaked information. Since he retired from his position of Director of National Intelligence, James Clapper has been a constant presence on political television. James Clapper lied when he told CNN's Don Lemon in March of 2017 that he did not interact with the media prior to leaving the Obama administration in January 2017. His reputation as a liar is bolstered by his testifying before a House panel that he leaked the made-up dossier to CNN's Jake Tapper while he was still serving as the Director of National Intelligence. The man is a classic liar who cannot keep his lies straight. This is the man who in 2015 barred all intelligence workers from providing the press any information to guard against leaks. Makes you wonder, what happened to that little directive? So, when Obama was president, Clapper was all about plugging the leaks. But as soon as Trump is elected, it's open the floodgates. From his new perch as news commentator, he's belched a steady stream of misinformation designed to undermine President Trump, including the outrageous claim that our president is somehow unfit for office. Clapper even predicted Muammar Gaddafi would prevail in Hillary's war, the rebel uprising in Libya, before the rebels dragged Gaddafi's body through the streets. He called the Islamic extremists, Muslim Brotherhood, largely secular. The comment came despite his own CIA labeling the Muslim Brotherhood a religious-based organization. Liar Clapper also lied to the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence when he said the NSA did not spy on Americans. Clapper told us that very few Americans are unmasked. He later had to admit in front of the Senate committee that in fact nearly 2,000 Americans were unmasked in Obama's last year in office alone. This was an increase of 350% during the Obama administration. And he has the nerve to say on national TV that President Trump is unfit for office? Which brings us to the lass of our little deep state threesome, liar Samantha Power. President Obama had a thing about hiring fiction writers like Power and Ben Rhodes, probably because he needed them to weave a believable narrative out of the web of falsehoods that characterized his presidency. The House Intelligence Committee has identified Rhodes, whose only postgraduate qualification is an MFA in fiction writing from NYU, as a person of interest in their investigation into the unmasking of Americans. As for Power, when it came out that she had unmasked more than one American per working day for the last year of the Obama presidency, the cleverest excuse she could come up with was, someone else did it. I'm not kidding. In testimony, in front of the House Committee on Oversight and Government Reform, Power had the unmitigated gall to say that most of the 260 unmasking requests that had her name on them were made by someone else. I did not make those requests, Power told the committee, according to Chairman Trey Gowdy. What the hell does that mean? Power's explanation can mean only one of two things. Either she's lying, or she's a pawn whose stupidity or naivete was exploited by members of the deep state. If the second explanation is true, it begs a very big question. Who used her name? The Samantha Power cover-up is one of the most intriguing and possibly explosive elements of the anti-Trump conspiracy. In October 2017, Judicial Watch, the conservative watchdog group, filed a Freedom of Information Act, FOIA, request to the U.S. State Department asking for information on Power's unusual unmasking request. That information included all requests for information submitted to any intelligence community member agency by former United States Ambassador to the United Nations, Samantha Power, concerning, regarding, or relating to the following. Any actual or suspected effort by the Russian government or any individual acting on behalf of the Russian government to influence or otherwise interfere with the 2016 presidential election. The alleged hacking of computer systems utilized by the Democratic National Committee and or the Clinton presidential campaign. Any actual or suspected communication between any member of the Trump presidential campaign or transition team and any official or employee of the Russian government or any individual acting on behalf of the Russian government. The identities of U.S. citizens associated with the Trump presidential campaign or transition team who were identified pursuant to intelligence collection activities. The State Department stonewalled the request, giving only a vague boilerplate denial. Then, in February 2018, Judicial Watch filed a lawsuit against the State Department. Why would the State Department go to court to keep this information secret? I can't imagine they'd go through all that trouble, hiring lawyers, paying legal fees, arguing their flimsy case in front of a judge, if they didn't have something very important to hide. The State Department came up with an ingenious excuse. In a letter dated May 23, 2017, the National Security Council informed Judicial Watch that all records pertaining to unmasking by Susan Rice had been removed to the Obama Library. Under the Presidential Records Act, that means they're closed to the public until 2021, or until the Obamas manage to suck enough tax dollars out of the citizens of Illinois to get their library built. If we do have to wait that long, I'd at least like to be kept up to date on the library planning. For example, will they be keeping the Susan Rice records in the fiction section or the nonfiction section? Maybe, by the time they're done filling the pages with black lines and crossouts, they can just hang them up on the walls like pieces of modern art, since nobody's going to be able to read the damn things anyway. It isn't the total lack of transparency that gets to me. We've all come to expect that from people at the highest levels of government. What bothers me about this are the lies. George W. Bush went to great lengths to make sure as few people as possible could find out what he was up to in the years immediately after 9/11. He signed an executive order that essentially gutted the Presidential Records Act, locking up who knows how many documents and conversations. And he took his share of beatings in the media for that. But that was a time of war. America had just been attacked, and desperate measures needed to be taken. Measures like torture that most of the American public couldn't stomach. Barack Obama took office during a time of peace. He whipped up an executive order that made it seem like he'd be letting the press and the American people in on every decision he was going to make in the White House and every conversation he'd be having. Executive Order 13489 said that only living former presidents could invoke executive privilege to keep documents hidden and made most documents of his predecessors even more accessible to the public than they'd ever been before. Obama reestablished the post of archivist of the United States, a government job whose occupant would be able to decide which records were in and which were out, and vowed to bring the records of his predecessors to light. Press ate it up. Suddenly, we were dealing with the most transparent administration in history. Yeah, right. Little did they know that while Obama was flashing EO 13489 around the Oval Office, his cronies in the deep state were fudging the rules and creating loopholes so fast none of us could keep up. They knew that when it came time to answer for their high crimes and misdemeanors, the records would be long gone, some bound for a dusty library in Illinois, where they'd be chopped up and redacted beyond recognition, others deleted accidentally, or spread among so many private servers that even the best prosecutor couldn't put all the pieces together. And the conspirators would all get off scot-free. Any documents that would indict them are long gone. Team Obama spent the years they were in power making sure of that. Years when they should have been governing and working to keep our citizens safe from harm. The Swamp King. Out of all the creatures in the swamp, maybe the most slippery is our former president, Barack Obama. Did you ever wonder to what lengths liberal Obama went to get his co-conspirator, his hand-picked successor, liar Hillary, elected to protect his legacy? Did you ever wonder what connection his administration had with the deep state? I have news for you. His administration was the deep state. Right from the start of his political career, there were questions about Obama. I knew nothing about him when he appeared on the political stage. With other presidents, it wasn't that way, right? You knew where they came from. If you're old enough, you knew Reagan was a movie star and then governor of California. You knew H.W. Bush was a Navy pilot, a war hero, and former director of the CIA. You even knew with his bell-bottoms, flag-burning wife and girlfriend Jennifer Flowers what you were getting with Bill Clinton. But Obama? Right out of nowhere. A first-term senator from Illinois, he appears in a puff of smoke, right out of a magic act. He then takes on the biggest political machine of our time, the Clintons, and blows them right out of the water. I don't know about you, but by the time I finished scratching my head, he was sitting in the Oval Office. Things didn't get any clearer for me throughout his 8 years as president. Who was this guy, and what was he up to? Only in looking back can we put the pieces of the puzzle together. Clue number one came during his first presidential campaign. It was then he hired the high priest of the deep state, John O. Brennan, as the national security advisor. In the Senate, he had played his Mr. Smith Goes to Washington Act to perfection, railing from the Senate floor about the Patriot Act, violating our fundamental notions of privacy. But once in the Oval, Jimmy Stewart turned into Joe Pesci from Goodfellas. He supported a law that legalized the NSA's warrantless eavesdropping and let telecom companies who aided the NSA in intruding in the lives of private citizens off the hook. By the end of his second term, he'd expanded warrantless eavesdropping on innocent Americans to the point that individual privacy no longer existed. By liar Obama's second term, any pretense of adherence to the Fourth Amendment, the principle of probable cause, and the judicial sanctioning of search warrants had all but disappeared. Even the supposed sanctum sanctorum of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, FISC, had been violated. In fact, the Obama administration had so little respect for the super-secret court, his NSA was reprimanded several times for lying to FISA judges. Sound familiar? If you know anything about the Steele dossier, it certainly does. And how did Obama react to the fact that his NSA was lying to FISA judges? He gave the agency's director, three-star General Keith Alexander, another star and as much money as he needed to erect an American spying operation that a comic book writer would have trouble imagining. So much for Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. Oh, and by the way, former President Obama's Director of National Intelligence, liar James R. Clapper, goes to Congress and tells them that the NSA doesn't spy on Americans. Here's how that came down. Senator Ron Wyden, Democrat, Oregon. So what I wanted to see is if you could give me a yes or no answer to the question, does the NSA collect any type of data at all on millions or hundreds of millions of Americans? Director of National Intelligence James Clapper, no, sir. Senator Wyden, it does not? Director Clapper, not wittingly, there are cases where they could inadvertently perhaps collect, but not wittingly. Then came Mr. Snowden. Oops! Turns out the NSA not only spies on Americans, it spies on practically every American. They even used Xboxes to spy on people. Clapper simply said he'd forgotten that small fact. Liar. After Edward Snowden exposed the breadth of spying under his administration, liar Obama excused his violator saying, I think it's important to recognize that you can't have 100% security and also then have 100% privacy and zero inconvenience. During his last few months in the White House during the 2016 presidential campaign and Donald Trump's transition, President Obama was engaged in some very secretive stuff. I don't mean the $200 million he sent to the PLO or the Taliban Five he let waltz out of Gitmo in exchange for deserter Bo Bergdahl, or the $104 million in cash, euros, and Swiss francs he sent to Iran. No, I'm talking about something much closer to home. After Donald Trump was elected president of the United States, an event that shocked the deep state to its core, Obama issued an executive order that allowed all 16 intelligence agencies to unmask Americans at will and without regard to any previously instituted privacy protections. Why was that, Mr. Former President? I'll tell you why. So he could unmask the names of Americans to the press. He sacrificed the privacy of countless Americans so that the names of a couple of people loosely connected to the Trump campaign who had contacts with Russians, would slip through the intelligence agency's sieve into the hands of the fake press. The idea that liar Obama as a pawn of the deep state didn't use his weaponized intelligence gathering capabilities against the threat of a Donald Trump presidency is ludicrous. Donald Trump knew this right from the beginning. They were spying on him. They were listening in on Trump Tower. They had Paul Manafort, who was Donald Trump's campaign chairman for all of 3 months and who lived on the 43rd floor of Trump Tower under constant surveillance. And if they accidentally happened to pick up conversations of people working for Donald Trump's presidential campaign or Donald Trump himself, well, that was purely coincidental, and they certainly wouldn't listen to them. Give me a break. And oh, how indignant the Obama administration was at even the suggestion they bugged candidate Trump, Cardinal Comey, and his sanctimonious, aw shucks, act in front of Congress, John Brennan and James Clapper doing all the Sunday morning news shows, lying to us yet again. The Obama mob was towing the line. Neither President Obama nor any White House official ever ordered surveillance on any U.S. citizen. Any suggestion otherwise is simply false, said Kevin Lewis, former President Obama's spokesperson. Well, well, what a smooth answer. Only a judge can issue a surveillance warrant. But you knew that, didn't you, Kevin? Why aren't we making all those outraged liberals eat their words? They had painted Donald Trump as a lunatic, crazy, a guy wearing a tinfoil hat. He thinks they were tapping his wires, they snickered. Well, guess what? They were. So he used the wrong word. The gist was right on. In our upside-down world, you can attack someone for telling the truth, and there is no consequence. Drives me nuts. Lewis's statement is misleading on its face. It's the FISA court that permits a surveillance. It's the Justice Department that asked the court to do it. The idea that liar Obama was somehow above the conspiracy against Donald Trump is hogwash. He has done much worse. Many believe Obama's intelligence agencies listened in and, in fact, recorded a phone call of Congressman Dennis Kucinich because he had the temerity to stand against Hillary's failed war in Libya. So why would he have any compunction to listening in on Hillary's opponent? To say Obama didn't condone or instruct his Justice Department to petition the court for permission either means Lewis doesn't know what he's talking about or he's lying. Guess which one I think it is. Obama has a history of asking courts to snoop on people. Ask my Fox News colleague, James Rosen. Rosen was the chief Washington correspondent for Fox News. In 2009, he broke a story that North Korea was about to respond to a UN Security Council resolution condemning their nuclear tests by testing a nuclear weapon. He got his information from a leaker in the State Department named Stephen Jin-Woo Kim. Obama's Justice Department obtained a warrant from a federal judge deeming Rosen criminal co-conspirator and a flight risk. Armed with the warrant, they captured his phone records, his emails from two accounts, and tracked him by phone traces. Even the New York Times and the Washington Post condemn the feds for the action. He also had a history of manipulating intelligence for political purposes. Just ask General Lloyd J. Austin III, CENTCOM commander, who oversaw a whitewash of Obama's war against ISIS by painting it in a positive way. Guess what? Obama's war wasn't going in a positive way. The truth is, the Obama administration was so desperate to keep Donald Trump from being elected that his Justice Department prodded by his CIA chief John O. Brennan, misled the most secret court of the United States. The goal was simple: spy on the Trump campaign to undermine a presidential election. Members of the highest echelon in Obama's FBI, CIA, and Department of Justice all conspired to prevent an outsider from breaking the establishment's stranglehold on the American people. They used a dossier of lies, paid for by a major political party, the Democratic National Committee, and a presidential candidate, Hillary Rodham Clinton, and even the FBI, to dupe the court. But based on text messages later found between FBI agent Peter Strzok and his girlfriend Lisa Page, they wanted to forum shop for their favorite judge, Rudolph Contreras, plotting their move under the pretense of a dinner party to get their warrant. They swore to facts they knew were lies to get what they wanted, to surveil a candidate they could not imagine being president. So was the FISA court duped, or was it complicit with the fraud? The top echelon of our intelligence agencies, whose salaries we pay, decided we didn't deserve a free and fair election. Why isn't this the biggest scandal in America today? Why isn't a sitting president's use of national security surveillance against a candidate from the opposite party in a presidential election at least as big as Watergate? The answer is, it is. Furthermore, former President Obama knew all along what Russia was up to. He didn't do anything because he and the establishment pollsters thought Hillary would win. He tells us, though, that he met with Putin and told him to knock it off. Picture this visual: Putin, bare-chested, riding his horse, and Obama riding a bicycle with his helmet on. Do you think Putin was scared? Do you even believe Obama said it? It was only after the election that he imposed sanctions on Russia. Why not before? Maybe because it's he who had the cozy relationship with Vladimir Putin and not Donald Trump. Let's look at the facts. Fact: in 2009, it was Obama's Vice President Joe Biden who first expressed the president's wish to press the reset button on the U.S.'s relationship with Russia. It was Obama's Secretary of State Hillary Clinton who met with the Russian foreign minister in Geneva, where together they pushed a symbolic button on which reset was printed in both English and Russian. It didn't matter that Obama's advance team, or whoever oversaw the details, misspelled the Russian word for reset and instead used one that meant overload. Everybody just got a big laugh about it because it was Obama who wanted to make nice with the Russian bear. Fact: it was Obama who was overheard speaking to Russian President Medvedev, asking for time with missile defense, and in that famous hot mic moment saying, "This is my last election. After my election, I have more flexibility." Fact: it was under Obama's watch when 20% of our uranium was sold to Putin with a $145 million kickback to the Clinton Foundation and a $500,000 speech fee paid to Bill by a Kremlin-connected company. Fact: it was Obama who put Putin in charge of overseeing the elimination of chemical weapons in Syria. Putin pressured Obama to let him handle the situation for his ally Assad, and Obama caved. Putting the fox in charge of the henhouse clearly failed, since chemical weapon elimination deadlines were missed repeatedly. You remember that? A line in the supermarket was taken more seriously than Obama's line in the sand. Fact: it was Obama who watched like a Cheshire cat as Russia invaded and annexed Ukraine and the Crimea Peninsula in 2014. He knew what was happening. Fact: long before she met with Don Jr., It was Obama's DOJ that let Russian lawyer Natalia Veselnitskaya into the United States without a visa, using a legal loophole called extraordinary circumstances. Obama's administration then allowed her to sit in the front row of a congressional hearing. So who's Russia's pal? Donald Trump or you, Mr. Former President? The facts speak for themselves. The witch hunt and false narrative put forth by the swamp's propaganda machine has turned the truth on its head. The United States president, who had the coziest relationship with Vladimir Putin, is not the one in the Oval Office today. It's good old Mr. Former President smooth-talking Barack, who pulled the wool over the eyes of all his fawning liberal lambs. Obama is the best evidence that the Democrat Party, who expects and relies on the African-American and Latino vote, does nothing for them. As we go to print, while every major media source is busy fantasizing about a Trump-Russia collusion, under Trump's administration, African-American unemployment rates are at an historic all-time low. As a presidential candidate, Trump had anticipated he could do as much when he told African-American voters, "What do you have to lose?" In August 2015, even before the first Republican primary debate, Trump was calling out Obama for his poor record on helping African-Americans. In an interview with ABC's Jonathan Carl, Trump said, "Obama has done nothing for African-Americans. You look at what's going on with their income levels. You look at what's gone on with their youth. I thought he would be a great cheerleader for this country. I thought he'd do a fabulous job for the African-American citizens of this country. He has done nothing." I agree. Just 18 months into his presidency, Trump accomplished what Obama couldn't do in two terms, provided concrete proof that African Americans are legitimately better off under the Trump presidency. The real deplorables, Crooked Hillary and Lying Bill. Any case against an anti-Trump conspiracy must include the high priestess of the deep state, liar Hillary Clinton. In January 2018, I took a camera crew to Chappaqua, New York, in search of Hillary. You might have seen the segment on my show, Justice with Judge Jeanine. In it, I stand at the edge of the woods that surround the quaint town, yelling her name. I peek into a local dry cleaner, asking whether she ever comes in and gets her famous pantsuits cleaned. It's good for a chuckle anyway. No, I didn't find her. I wasn't expecting to. If she weren't so good at keeping herself out of the spotlight when she has to, she'd have been thrown in jail a long time ago. Still, in her own hometown, we thought there'd be a chance of getting some good interviews with people who know her. But none of the businesses we stopped at, from pizza parlors to nail salons, had seen any sign of her for months. As the owner of a bookstore told me, she rarely came into town anymore. While Bill would stop at the store and look around quite often, Hillary usually ordered her books, and I bet her white wine, by phone. She would then send someone into town to pick them up. Her reluctance to come into town and mingle with the hard-working Americans who run the shops there shouldn't surprise you. She's a Clinton, after all. And Clintons don't leave the house for less than $250,000 per trip. They figure if you're going to talk to people, you might as well get paid for it. Nice work if you can get it, right? Bill has been doing it for years and making big piles of cash for his time. It's no surprise that Hillary has decided to do the same thing. You would think that being the most famous loser in the world wouldn't look as good on an event program as former president. Yet, Hillary has made it work for herself. She's still cashing plenty of checks on her boo-hoo tour. Since losing the election in the worst upset in American electoral history, Hillary Clinton has given over 50 paid speeches blaming just about everyone she can think of for the loss except, of course, herself. The sad truth of the matter is that she's got a captive audience. There's a whole group of whiners who haven't gotten over the fact that Donald J. Trump won the presidency of the United States fair and square. They don't like that he's securing our borders, making trade fairer for Americans, lowering unemployment, boosting the economy, lowering taxes, putting North Korea on its knees, and creating a strategy together in the Middle East. They just want someone to blame, and Hillary, as always, is happy to provide. For instance, she made a speech at the India Today Conclave, which was held in Mumbai just a few weeks prior to this writing. If you thought her basket of deplorables remark during the 2016 presidential campaign was bad, get a load of this. I call it the Basket of Deplorables Part 2. Liar Hillary, it seems, just can't help herself. In Mumbai, she continued to call Trump supporters misogynist, racist, and immigrant haters. And his whole campaign, Make America Great Again, was looking backward, she said. You didn't like black people getting rights. You don't like women, you know, getting jobs. You don't want to, you know, see that Indian American succeeding more than you are. You know, whatever your problem is, I'm going to solve it. While the audacity of Hillary Clinton never truly surprises me anymore, trying to list all the lies that leave this woman's mouth is like trying to count the snowflakes in a buffalo blizzard. Trump supporters don't like women getting jobs? Really? Why doesn't she tell that to Kellyanne Conway, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, Betsy DeVos, Gina Haspel, Nikki Haley, and Seema Verma, both of whom are, ironically, of Indian descent? How about the millions of women who voted for Trump, the ones who must have real jobs to support their families because no one's going to pay them hundreds of thousands of dollars to babble on stage? When I first ran for county judge in 1989, my critics said, "We can't have a woman county judge. She won't be strong enough to sentence people." That made me laugh. What a joke. The people who said that obviously hadn't met me. Still, I held a press conference where I assured voters I had the intestinal fortitude to sentence anyone to life. What they didn't know was that I had the fortitude to sentence a man to death. I made history in Westchester when I was elected the first woman county judge. My being a mother of two babies was proof of my incompetence to some of my peers. "You can't be a judge and a good mother," one guy said to me. He was wrong. I was a duty judge, meaning I was on call 24/7. During the week of Christmas, I was called into work and I didn't have a babysitter. So I took my toddler son, Alex, to court with me and hid him under my bench while I arraigned a shackled, out-of-state murder defendant. I thought I had gotten away with it until he started yelling, "Mommy, it's dark!" Moms do what they have to do. In 1993, the first time I ran for DA, the concern wasn't about my credentials and whether I had the fortitude to do the job. It was about who would take care of my little kids if I couldn't get home at night. Al, my husband at the time, and I had to issue a statement that if I couldn't get home at night, he would watch the kids. The guy I was running against, Michael Cherkasky, had three kids, and his wife was pregnant with their fourth. I only had two. No one ever asked him about who would be watching his kids. It was ridiculous, but it was classic. I was never a bra burner or ballistic about that stuff. It was just the way things were, and I had to work within that context. My job was to be at least as good as any guy and just get it done. And I did. Hillary says Trump supporters don't like working women. Let her say that to my face. Hillary also floated the notion that white women only voted for Donald Trump because their husbands told them to. I don't know about you, but the day a man tells me how I'm going to cast my vote is the day I'm dead. But maybe things are different in the Clinton household. There, when your husband tells you to go dig up dirt on the women he's been running around with behind your back, you do it. You even set up a war room in the White House for it. In Mumbai, liar Hillary wasn't finished. She also called all Trump voters, wait for it, slackers. Yep, good-for-nothing lazy slobs. That's what half of America is to Hillary. This coming from a woman who wouldn't get off her ass to go to Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin when she needed to in the last weeks of the campaign and ended up losing all three states. She couldn't find Wisconsin on a map, and neither could any of the brilliant political operatives to whom she was paying six-figure salaries to run the campaign while she spewed her hate. But she never really cared about Wisconsin or the other states in what she and the other liberal elites consider flyover country. If you look at the map of the United States, there's all that red in the middle where Trump won, Clinton said. I win the coast. I win, you know, Illinois and Minnesota, places like that. But what the map doesn't show you is that I won the places that represent two-thirds of America's gross domestic product. I won the places that are optimistic, diverse, dynamic, moving forward. She wears her disdain for the heartland of America as a badge of honor. Hillary, if you really want to know what happened, here's a hint. He won, you lost. You lost because you were a lousy candidate. You didn't have a message and you lied just about every time you opened your mouth. You put our national security at risk with your email setup and ran a foundation that was nothing more than an organized pay-to-play enterprise parading as a charity. Four men died in the attack in Benghazi under your watch as you lied about what caused it. I could go on, but my listeners might have something to do next Thursday. Stop with the poor me nonsense, Hillary. We've had it with you, Clintons, always claiming victimhood. You say you take absolute personal responsibility? Well, how does that square with blaming everyone, including just about all middle America? The truth is, you're damn lucky you're not in jail wearing a cheaper version of one of your pantsuits. And you say it's a painful process reliving the campaign? Think about the rest of us. Since as far back as we can remember, we had to watch you go from one lie to the next. I know how you operate from firsthand experience. Allow me to enter a bit of background. It was 2005, and I was just finishing up my third term as district attorney in Westchester County. During my time as DA, I ran an office that prosecuted virtually every type of criminal. Robbers, rapists, murderers, drug dealers, mobsters, and cyber criminals. When it came to domestic violence abuse and sex offenders, I was relentless. It's the way I've always been and the way I'll remain. I go with my gut, always have. I've lived by that my entire life with one exception. When I agreed at the insistence of the Republican Party to run against Hillary for U.S. Senator in New York. That wasn't my first rodeo. I'd campaigned before, but it was the first time I'd run against a political machine like the Clintons. Let me refresh your memory. Hillary was running for the junior U.S. Senate seat in New York State. Bill and Hillary had slipped into the leafy town of Chappaqua in 1999 just in time to qualify for her first run in 2000. But this was 2005, and Hillary was up for re-election, even though she had no plans to stay a senator for long. Oh, no. She already had her carpet bags packed for her 2008 run for the White House. Becoming a senator was just a stepping stone. For the record, I was born and raised in the upstate city of Elmira, New York. There, I worked on a dairy farm while going to school. I wasn't completely naive. I knew what I was in for. People always attack you when you run for office. If you don't have thick skin, you should get the hell out of the race. But it was different running against Hillary. Suddenly, there were things that the press attributed to me that were just lies. Early in my campaign, we visited a farm. When we were leaving, one of my staffers handed me an article about the visit. That article had been written ahead of time. Most of the facts in the story weren't true. Although I didn't understand what it was at the time, I came to find out that it was fake news with, surprise, surprise, Hillary Clinton's gang orchestrating the whole thing. When I got home from the farm that night, I was a bit shell-shocked. My boots were clean, but it still felt like I had stepped in crap. I'd spent my life as DA. I'd grown accustomed to truth and justice. This is what happened. These are the facts. What good were facts in the world of national politics? That night, I knew I couldn't finish the race. Politics with the Clintons in the picture became all about lies and smears. The message didn't matter, and neither did integrity. That's not a game I was willing to play. It still isn't. Later, a former Clinton advisor told me Hillary had me in her sights since I was a native New Yorker and rising Republican star with a record of accomplishment. He told me she's a powerful enemy to have. But I'll give you this, Hillary. You did say one thing in that Mumbai speech that had some merit. When someone asked whether Vladimir Putin might have something on Donald Trump, a question that is right out of the liberal conspiracy textbook, you gave the India Today conclave this response. Follow the money, you said. Why, Hillary, I thought you'd never ask. As of this writing, the hard-working men and women at the FBI, and not their politicized bosses, are investigating the Clinton Foundation. What are they looking for? Donations to the Clinton Foundation that directly influenced official actions taken by Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. The old pay-to-play scheme. It's as old as politics itself. Money goes in, favors and contracts come out. A ruthless, profit-driven woman, liar Hillary's attempted ascension to the presidency was all about money and power. Underneath those pantsuits were pure corruption, crookedness, and a callous disregard for morality. She covered for her sexual predator husband and her sexual predator financial supporters in that den of iniquity known as Hollywood. She hated anyone in the economic class beneath her, and she headed an organized pay-to-play enterprise parading as a 501c3 charity known as the Clinton Foundation. How big of a crime are we talking about? Well, ask yourself this. How do two people who start with nothing, without a business, without a product, without any practical business expertise, amass a fortune worth hundreds of millions of dollars? How do you go from dead broke to rolling in dough while working in the government? I'll tell you how. You use your position and power to engage in a give and take. Since the day it filed for tax-exempt status with the Internal Revenue Service, don't get me started on those wackadoos, the Clinton Foundation has been little more than the world's biggest superstore for political favors and under-the-table deals. Foreign heads of state, some of whom are antagonists to the United States, make donations, and in return they get all the power and influence that comes with being a former president of the United States or secretary of state. And because these are donations to charity which for Americans are tax-deductible under the Internal Revenue Code, the amounts are much larger than your typical campaign contribution. It's a simple arrangement when you think about it, but it's also easy to screw up. That's why most amateurs